Thank you. Everybody, ole. We're gonna read. Welcome back, everybody. We're gonna read this little gem of an article that Penny sent. This is takes it to a higher level here, everybody. Oh my God, we are so close to this blowing wide open, boy. Okay, let's read this. February 14th, 2014. A 77, which adds up to a 14 as well, which is a number 5. It's time for a big honkin' change, everybody. The winds of change, March, coming in here. Ides of March or next 15th or so. And I've heard many rumors, Mama. I don't know if you've seen them on the internet, that the 15th was going to be the day when they were going to pull the whole thing, you know. Rama, are you listening? That means pull even the quantitative easing, pull everything. No more playing like you're doing everything, 16,000, blah, blah. Okay. The title of this article, everybody, is Suicides of Bank Executives, Fraud, Financial Manipulation, colon, J.P. Morgan Chase advisor Tony Blair is not involved. By Professor Michel Chasudovsky from Global Research. URL of this article, www.globalresearch.ca. / and then the name of the article. I'll read it again. Suicides of Bank Executives, Fraud, Financial Manipulation, J.P. Morgan Chase's advisor Tony Blair is not involved. A hyphen between every single one of those words. And then a forward slash, and then the numbers 5368627. 536 8627. Okay, J.P. Morgan Chase is the unspoken architect of fraud, corruption, not to mention the establishment of the largest Ponzi scheme in world history. The agenda is to steal and appropriate wealth through market manipulation. Quote, just last month, J.P. Morgan Chase acknowledged that it facilitated the largest Ponzi scheme in history. Looking the other way, as Bernie Madoff brazenly turned his business bank account at J.P. Morgan Chase into an unprecedented money laundering operation that would have set off bells, whistles, and sirens at any other bank. I remember when Rama, I remember when Elizabeth Warren was on Bill Maher's show,
And he was
and
begging
then Bill
her.
Maher is begging her to fix the mess. He said, you don't want to know how much I put into the Bernie Madoff scandal. It's all gone. Boo-hoo. And guess what? This leads right up to Chris Christie's doorstep, along with Marco Rubio. Both of them. You know, they were the butlers, you know. House boys. Yeah, that's right. Just like that big one, the whole thing, the original note holder back in 1945, 49. No, the other one. Mr. Sam Brown, and this is a private conversation, and we really love to lie. And this is a formal disclaimer. He has been described as the houseboy of SBC Charco. And again, this is a private conversation. But this is what this is connected to. This isn't the top of the line. That is. And that's where the Nasara plan began. right then and there, 1949. Little Bister Israel there became a state of the United States as well as a country when Jerusalem, they claim, is not even over there. As we're reading When Rocks Cry Out, Jerusalem is in South America. I like to be in America. Everything's free in America. What is for me in America? What is more than me in America? Yes, West Side Story was a very good beginning of the story, everybody. What a beautiful, beautiful show. That was, saw that on Broadway in Chicago. Actually, not New York Broadway, Chicago's strip there. Okay, so the agenda is to steal and appropriate wealth through market manipulation. Just last month, J.P. Morgan admitted to this thing of facilitating this, looking the other way as Bernie Madoff brazenly turned his business bank account at J.P. Morgan Chase into an unprecedented money laundering operation that would have set off bells, whistles, and sirens at any other bank. The United States Justice Department allowed J.P. Morgan to pay $1.7 billion and sign a deferred prosecution agreement, meaning no one goes to jail at J.P. Morgan again. The largest question that no one can, this is why Eric Holder is in deep doo-doo, everybody, over his eyebrows and his crown chakra in deep doo-doo. Naughty boy. I don't want you to know everything all at once, huh? But it's all coming out now. What I'm saying is that there's only two players in the seat of power position, that's Barack Obama and Nancy Pelosi, that are double agents at that realm. And then 64 good members of Congress, and everybody else has got to go pay the piper time. Okay, the largest question that no one can or will answer is how the compliance, legal and anti-money laundering personnel at J.P. Morgan ignored for years hundreds of transfers and billions of dollars in round-trip maneuvers between Bernie Madoff and the account of Norman Levy. Every one such maneuver should set off an investigation. Levy is now deceased, and the trustee for Madoff's victims has settled with his estate. Unquote. Pam Martin's, Russ Martin's, J.P. Morgan vice president's death shines light on banks' close ties to the C blank A Wall Street Parade .com. Yeah, you can go to Wall Street Parade .com, everybody. February 12, 2014, to successfully implement its various financial operations. J.P. Morgan Chase not only controls politicians in high office, it also uses retired politicians to undertake advisory functions. Upon his retirement from the position of Prime Minister, Tony Blair was appointed to a senior advisory position at J.P. Morgan Chase. His initial fee for this part-time consultancy was a modest retainer of £500,000 a year, which is $750,000. That's $750,000. It was subsequently increased to £2,000,000 a year, which is probably £250,000,000, $250,000,000. Tony Blair was slated a year a year. This has been going on for a very, very, very long time. Decades. Multiply that, $250 million a year times 20. $250 billion would be times 10, right? Yeah. So double that, $500 billion. Lovely days in there. Almost a trillionaire, dear boys and girls. And remember, Mitt Romney is a multi-trillionaire. And he has been a mass murderer. And you get paid for that kind of stuff, you know? Tony Blair was slated to use his network of crony politician political relations in Britain and the Middle East to serve the interests of J.P. Morgan Chase. He worked closely with CEO and chairman Jamie Dimon, who has recently been the object of controversy. Quote, "We operate our business all over the world," unquote, said Jamie Dimon. Quote, "And Tony Blair will bring our leaders and clients a unique and invaluable global perspective that is especially critical in turbulent times like these. Our firm will benefit greatly from his knowledge and experience," unquote. J.P. Morgan, January 2008 press release. There's a picture of Tony Blair down here, a green background, and there's blood all over his face and all over the background and all over his shoulder, everywhere. Remember, he killed Kelly. What was Kelly's first name? Dr. David Kelly. Because Dr. David Kelly, he knew that he, what did he know? Forgot. Yeah, that they orchestrated 9/11 together, and that Tony Blair's little dossier on saying that it was a fact that Saddam Hussein had a delivery system to deliver a nuke to downtown London in 45 minutes, per a lovely little paper, PhD paper, from the University of California's San Diego campus. Word for word. That's called balls, everybody, and stupidity on the top of that. It is worth noting that in 2003, after the invasion of Iraq, during Tony Blair's mandate as Prime Minister, J.P. Morgan Chase was designated to run the Trade Bank of Iraq. Now we're getting to the top of the line about dinar fraud. This is full of bloody, bloody stuff, everybody. Tony Blair is a war criminal who has links to a fraudulent banking network of great global proportions. Mysterious deaths of four senior Wall Street bank executives. Here where we come in again. Oh, we'll just see because there's more after that. In recent developments on January, J.P. Morgan Chase vice president in the UK, Gabriel McGee, was found dead at a ninth level rooftop of the bank's 33-story European headquarters building in the Canary Wharf section of London. On February 10th, Ryan Henry Crane, 37, another senior J.P. Morgan Chase executive, died under mysterious circumstances. Crane was responsible for J.P. Morgan's global program trading. Crane's death comes after a rash of suicides, so-called suicides, over a period of 6 days involving three prominent banksters, including J.P. Morgan's Gabriel McGee, former Federal Reserve economist Michael Duker, and William Brokschmidt, a former senior manager for Deutsche Bank, who was found hanging in his home, also an apparent suicide. Bull pucky, everybody. Brokschmidt was, according to reports, connected to the process of rigging of foreign exchange markets. Appointment of Tony Blair. Text of January 2008 press, J.P. Morgan Chase press release, New York, January 10th. Newswire first call. JP Morgan Chase announced today that it has appointed former British Prime Minister Tony Blair, that's 2008, right, in a senior advisory capacity to the firm, effective immediately. Mr. Blair will also join the company's international council. Mr. Blair will advise J.P. Morgan Chase's CEO and senior management team on a part-time basis, drawing on his immense international experience to provide the firm with strategic advice and insight on global political issues and emerging trends. In addition, Mr. Blair will participate in select events and conferences for the company, including senior-level client events, and will provide briefings on political trends to the firm's board of directors. Quote, "We're honored that Tony Blair has chosen to join J.P. Morgan Chase as a senior advisor to our executive team and board," said Jamie Dimon, chairman and CEO. Quote, "We operate our business all over the world, and Tony Blair will bring our leaders and clients." Oh, we get right out of here. Tony Blair added, "It is a great opportunity to be able to contribute to the work of J.P. Morgan Chase. They are a leading company at the cutting edge of the global economy with a footprint in virtually every part of the globe. I look forward to advising them on how they approach the huge political and economic changes the globalization brings. I am excited at the prospect of joining Jamie Dimon, for whom I have a lot of respect, and the whole team, adding my own experience to their work and helping them to grow. J.P. Morgan Chase & Company, New York, JPM, is a leading global financial services firm with assets of $1.5 trillion and operations in more than 50 countries. The firm is a leader in investment banking, financial services for customers, small businesses and commercial banking, financial transaction processing, asset management, private equity, a component of the Dow Jones Industrial Average. J.P. Morgan Chase serves millions of customers in the United States and many of the world's most prominent corporations, institutional and governmental clients under its J.P. Morgan and Chase brands. J.P. Morgan Chase is committed to investment in education, economic opportunity, development, and environmental programs that enable people and communities to thrive. Information about the firm is available at jpmorganchase.com. Doesn't that sound lovely, everybody? What a lovely day in the neighborhood. Mr. Rogers' neighborhood, everybody. That's the end of that article. Okay, now let's do a little positive thing, and then we'll do about an hour maybe of this, and we'll do the next hour next week. We're going to do something from Michael Tellinger, and it's about, what's that called again? Well, yeah, but it's about what South Africa's, isn't it about that? It's not? Oh, okay. Which one? You got to talk louder. Say it loud. Okay.
Inner world, outer world.
Oh, that one. Okay, well, is that 2 hours too? Oh, okay, well, then you don't want to do the Michael Tellinger at all? Not even an hour of it? No? No? Okay, well, let's save that for a little bit later, and then we'll finish what we want to do on the TV if you don't want to do that. Okay. This is called Dita Ellis' Groundbreaking Star Trek Medicine, A Reality. Bioresonance. Source, The Watcher, James 6, J-H-A-I-N-E-S, the number 6, wordpress.com/page/4. No www. Just HTTP:// Thought Dr. McCoy had it good with his equipment on the Starship Enterprise? Wait until you get a load of what is coming to revolutionize the world of medicine. Medicine has just got exciting thanks to Russian scientists and over 17 years of in-depth research. The future has arrived, and just as three-dimensional printing will revolutionize manufacturing, this technology will revolutionize the practice of medicine. This groundbreaking medical technology is making many people a lot of money in Russia. Why? Because it destroys the pharmaceutical paradigm and the doctors that practice it, using electromagnetic vibration to diagnose and cure without side effects, yet with pinpoint precision. Stay with this, okay, Rama? Beta Ellis electromagnetic bioresonance therapy devices will be sweeping the globe just like cell phones and computers. Who has endorsed this technology? President Putin of Russia uses it, and the Department of Health in Russia has approved it for wide use across their nation, which amounts to 300 million people. Oh my God. That's the same amount of people that are in the United States. They just got a slightly big piece of property on the planet, everybody. Oh my God. You could probably fit about what? 1, 2, 3, 4, maybe 5 or 6 United States in the amount of land they have. The Russian space program uses this technology because it enables convenient and non-invasive monitoring and enhancing of the health of their cosmonauts. Medicine just became more affordable. I told you Russia was way ahead of us. More accurate and infinitely safer with Delta Ellis technology. Well, now it's got an L in it. Up there it just said Dita. Maybe somebody, no, which one is which? No. Okay. The first stop in this revolution is hepatitis B and C, as well as herpes. Russian doctors are claiming, what's that word, Rama? A 90% cure. Do something, drink something or something. A 90% cure rate for these incurable infections. Everyone is familiar with the fact that you can shatter a glass with sound. Now it's back to Dita Ellis machines, called the Dita AP, will shatter viruses, bacteria, and fungi, coming to us just as antibiotics became more of a terror than a help. This phenomena, where we can kill microbes with frequencies, is called bioresonance. And this is the principle that these Dita Ellis devices use to cure. Those who know of preceding technology like Hulda Clark's Zapper will soon be able to afford Dita Ellis machines. I know that our friend Kent said that Hulda Clark Zapper, that wasn't really the right thing. So I'm just going to say that it wasn't the right thing. It had some other deleterious side effects with the hypertension. So this new technology has gone beyond that anyway, which will be like The data Ellis machine, which will be like cell phones and soon even smaller, that will wipe out every infection imaginable with laser precision. Let us consider it a zapper on steroids times 1,000 for starters. Without the side effects, everybody. With this too-good-to-be-true form of medicine, bioresonance, one can have their diagnosis already in hand. From a Western practitioner, and use one of the treatment machines that one can buy as a consumer patient. Very soon, even similar models will be available like MP3 players, and one will be able to download, like on an iPad application, that will address specific medical problems. So, as you are traveling, for example, and come down with gastroenteritis, you can download on your personal computer the AP, the app, for gastroenteritis, and run it until you get better. The application program will contain, this is what Micah was talking about, only using the radionics frequencies, and then you can have the app and download it, and you can run those frequencies too. This is just very awesome, everybody. The application program will contain all the frequencies for eradicating the bacteria responsible for gastroenteritis. This is a 21st century medicine at its best. Just as bioresonance can be used to balance a part of the body, it can also be used to destroy parasites and bacteria. By far better than explaining, it is to watch a 33-second video and see it in action. And there is a YouTube video there. But Rama, you'll put this in, post it. But Penny, please send this back again, this, because we need the pictures. They didn't come out here. Thank you, sister. Okay, can you see the power of this? Once diagnosed with a particular parasite or virus, it can be targeted with a particular frequency that will cause no harm to anything else except kill the parasite or the virus. The video above shows parasites exploding, yet for a very clear demonstration on glass, in slow motion, watch the following, and then there's another YouTube there. These are the things for viewing. Okay, in the future, after practitioners are trained, Dieta Ellis diagnostic machines will reveal the exact parasite, virus, bacteria, or fungus present, and then the treatment device is programmed to destroy, and destroy it does. Though most of this is pre-programmed into the device diagnostics, takes wings to a new level that pins down a patient's overall chronic problems, translates that into a frequency, and then an exact positive outburst from the device will over several hours shower the wearer with the perfect healing frequency. First, we destroy everything that does not belong inside of us with one Dieta Ellis device. And then we set upon the task of rebuilding our organs and numerous biological systems with another called the Dieta RITM, as in Mary, device, which helps to RIT as in Tom, M as in Mary. TM, huh? Transcendental Meditation? Research into Transcendental Meditation device. Which helps to heal and rejuvenate organ pathologies and physiological systems. such as the immune system. God, help yourself. Yeah, me too. Okay, which helps heal and rejuvenate organ pathologies and physiological systems, such as the immune system, the circulatory system, the hormonal system, and the like. Infectious control in the 21st century certainly is not going to be anything like that of the 20th century. The age of antibiotics is about over, as great harm has been done to the world's populations with them. We have come close to compromising our biological existence with this reckless use of antibiotics. Now, we have antibiotic-resistant strains of pathogens encroaching on our biospheres, and it is getting increasingly dangerous to set foot anywhere near a hospital. Yep. Many people, including children, who die in the hospital after surgery, die not from the surgery itself, rather from the infections they get and that get out of control from the hospital environment. Infections caused 68% of children's deaths in hospitals. Not with DTaLLIS devices in your pocket, as there is no chance of creating antibiotic-resistant bugs or catching these from a hospital. Every organ of the body has its own special frequency. The lung resonates at 72 cycles per second, also known as Hertz. As the lung becomes infected, its frequency will fall out of balance, usually dropping a few Hertz. It has been discovered that by producing the same frequency as a healthy lung with a frequency generator, we can rebalance the lung and induce healing. This process is called bioresonance and can be used on all parts of the body. There have been many researchers that have worked on energy medicine and bioresonance this past century, such as Dr. Reif, Dr. Voll, Dr. Schimmel, Dr. Morell, and others. Some of the machines developed through the years run as high as $40,000. The Russians have outdone everyone, bringing this technology into medical and healthcare practices as well as into every home. Over the last 17 years, the Russian scientists, spearheaded by Dr. Konoblov, K-O-N-O-B-L-O-V, a medical doctor and a PhD physicist, have developed small portable devices that are innovative, cutting edge, at only a fraction of the cost of previous generation machines. Using pharmaceutical poisons just got that much more insane. Remember, as cell phones came out, or the personal computer, in 5 years, we will see everyone walking around not just with his or her cell phone, rather also with a safe therapeutic device. That will put health empowerment back into people's hands. The Russians conducted extensive studies on over 25,000 people and established an accurate system of analyzing and reinforcing energetic health of the organs and their connection to specific areas on the skin, dermal visceral zones. As a result of these devices' action, a weakened organ receives energy needed for normal functioning, which is redistributed on a wide scale, restoring their workability. Thousands of people have been able to cut down on their dosages of medicines. and in some cases have entirely stopped taking them and have regained excellent health. Gentle, safe medicine just became a reality, so doctors can now go back to the Hippocratic Oath that says, quote, first, do no harm when treating people. These gentle devices achieve exactly this. They can heal without being invasive and without causing harmful side effects. The devices can be used with children and pets and can therefore act as your family doctor. One of the most extraordinary claims coming out of Russia answers a long-standing problem in energy medicine, and that is the problem of measuring results. They are claiming that the results can be confirmed by all well-known diagnostic methods. To date, Dita Ellis has developed more than 3,000 treatment programs with an overall positive effect in many health problems in excess of 85%. To my devoted readers and patients, this is my first communication to the Western world about this rising technology. In January of 2014, these devices will also be manufactured in Germany, making them much more accessible. The Russian business plan is a traditional multi-level marketing model with Dr. George Giorgio, PhD, ND, Doctor of Science, AM, an expert in energy medicine and holistic medicine at the very top in the English-speaking world, selected to train doctors and practitioners in bioresonance testing and treatment. I'll spell his name, Dr. George Giorgio. And then he's got a PhD, an ND, Doctor of Naturopathy, a DSC, Doctor of Science, and then in parentheses it's got AM. I'm quite sure what that means. Atomic medicine? I don't know. Okay. This is perfect for those who want to make a business opportunity with this technology. And it is a good, boy, we're going to go back to natural medicine in the blink of an eye, everybody. It is a good setup for practitioners who will be using the diagnostic machines and selling the treatment devices to patients. For a small taste of that, see this following video on Dita Ellis at our big celebration and award party. At their big celebration and award party. It is exciting and it is Russian. It would also be worth watching this other 5-minute video about the company and their innovative devices. All of this is listed here. Like I said, Ron will get this up on our website. No doubt, as I publish this document, there will be a rush to obtain this new technology. My patients from around the world will be given priority, and then, of course, my readers who will come under my banner with Dita Ellis. Practitioners of every stripe are invited, as well as patients who want to learn to use the bioresonance approach on their own. Treatment devices like the Dita A app and the Dita RITM are approximately 500 euros, $675 US dollars each. Yet even less expensive units will come next year with simpler design in a mini version with the ability to download your own frequencies for a wide range of ailments. Diagnostic machines start at 2,500 euros or $3,400. And their most sophisticated combined diagnostic and treatment device, the DITA Professional, goes as low as €8,000, which is $11,000. About one fifth of the price of similar units. You can see all of these devices at www.data-ellis-elis-uk.com. DETA, D as in David, E, T as in Tom, A, hyphen, E, L, I, S as in Sam, hyphen, UK.com. Compare that to the cost of most medical equipment and drugs, as well as therapies, and one can see that the one-time startup cost for the consumer or practitioner is more than reasonable. Obamacare, on the other hand, will undoubtedly fail, as it should, because it promotes the wrong type of medicine at obscene prices. You know and I know that Obama knows, too. What he's doing is he's waking people up, because the subject is already on MSNBC and already on, you know, our folks that Democracy Now, that how much money are the insurance buddies making off of us still and yet, even though it's supposedly cheaper. And we just learned on the, you know, on things that we've been picking and playing for you. Everything else is in the in other countries where they would charge for something, it'd be one third the price. And then they have public health, which means that the tax dollars that the people pay goes into paying for that, so that no matter what, you always get to go. But now, just think about setting up these healing centers with these devices and these trainings. Healing teacher training centers. Where are you, Lynn? Okay, that's the end. Republished with permission from I, M as in Mary, V as in Victory, A, written by Dr. Mark Sirkus, S-I-R-C-U-S, an acupuncturist, an O-M-D, and a D-M, Director, International Medical Veritas Association, Doctor of Oriental and Pastoral Medicine. Now, that's a real doctor, well, folks. Posted in health/big pharma/insurance/food supply/spiritual, and then a straight up and down line, not a slash, just a straight up and down line. And then it says 18 comments. That was golden, Penny. Thank you for finding that. What a golden piece of information, everybody. There is so much hope. No more pain, no more suffering. Healing our bones and our teeth. Toothless Annie here, can't wait. Rego these teeth. Reverse this aging process. Okay, Pacha. Oh, let me read this real quick and then we'll do some more stuff. Maybe we should do the Rama. Yeah, maybe we should do the medicine now. The meditation. Because that was I'll just read this K. Pacha thing one more time. My life can change at the top of the hat. Risking, rushing me forward or setting me back. Beneath the surface of so much tension sprouts the seed of my soul's future intention. Happy Valentine's Day. And what better way to celebrate it than a full moon in Leo? Never mind the Saturn square, ha ha. Good time to be brainstorming and taking those beautiful ideas and finding creative ways to share them. Like we do here every time we come together, everybody. Personally, romantically, and practically. Having an awesome weekend. You have one too. All right. Let's do this meditation. It's a good time. Get yourself settled. Let's let all these things go, because, wow, we've gotten a lot today, despite all the other antics of machines and forgettings and listening to stray messages about things that took us a longer time to fix. We should have listened to Uncle Don and got 8 rams of memory extra. Now we got to do that too. The angels of abundance be with us. Okay, what's the title of this, Rama? Inner worlds, outer worlds. This is part one. Does it say what that is? Part one? Okay, let me read this. Part one of the film, Inner Worlds, Outer Worlds. Akasha is the unmanifested, the no-thing or emptiness, which fills the vacuum of space. As Einstein realized, empty space is not really empty. Yeah, maybe you can go turn that light off. I don't need that light. Yeah. Saints, sages, and yogis who have looked within themselves have also realized that within the emptiness is unfathomable power, a web of information or energy which connects all things. This matrix or web has been called the Logos, the Higgs field, the primordial Om, and 1,000 other names throughout history. In part one of Inner Worlds, we explore the one vibratory source that extends through all things. Through the science of kinematics, the concept of the Logos, the Vedic concept of Nada Brahma, the universe is sound or vibration. Once we realize that there is one vibratory source that is the root of all scientific and spiritual investigation, how can we say, my religion, my God, or my discovery? Everything has a source before us. Frequently ask questions about the film. Where can I get a particular song or a soundtrack? Much of the music is available for purchase. Okay. We don't need to go there. Let's start now, everybody. Make yourself comfortable. If you can lay down, that's okay too. All right, here we go.
In the beginning was the Logos, the Big Bang, the primordial Om. Big Bang theory says that the physical universe spiraled out of an unimaginably hot and dense single point called a singularity, billions of times smaller than the head of a pin. It does not say why or how. The more mysterious something is, the more we take for granted that we understand it. It was thought that eventually gravity would either slow the expansion or contract the universe in a big crunch. However, images from the Hubble Space Telescope show that the universe's expansion seems to be actually accelerating, expanding faster and faster as it grows out of the Big Bang. Somehow, there is more mass in the universe than physics predicted. To account for the missing mass, physicists now say that the universe consists of only 4% atomic matter, or what we consider normal matter. 23% of the universe is dark matter, and 73% is dark energy, what we previously thought of as empty space. It is like an invisible nervous system that runs throughout the universe, connecting all things. The ancient Vedic teachers taught Nada Brahma, the universe is vibration. The vibratory field is at the root of all true spiritual experience and scientific investigation. It is the same field of energy that saints, Buddhas, yogis, mystics, priests, shamans, and seers have observed by looking within themselves. It has been called Akasha, the primordial Om, Indra's net of jewels, the music of the spheres, and a thousand other names throughout history. It is the common root of all religions. And the link between our inner worlds and our outer worlds. In Mahayana Buddhism in the 3rd century, they described a cosmology not unlike the most advanced physics of modern day. Indra's net of jewels is a metaphor used to describe a much older Vedic teaching, which illustrates the way the fabric of the universe is woven together. Indra, the king of the gods, gave birth to the sun and moves the winds and the waters. Imagine a spider web that extends into all dimensions. The web is made up of dewdrops, and every drop contains the reflection of all the other water drops. And in each reflected dewdrop, you will find the reflections of all the other droplets, the entire web in that reflection, and so on to infinity. Indra's web could be described as a holographic universe, where even the smallest stream of light contains the complete pattern of the whole. The Serbian-American scientist Nikola Tesla is sometimes referred to as the man who invented the 20th century. Tesla was responsible for discovering alternating current electricity and many other creations that are now part of everyday life. Because of his interest in the ancient Vedic traditions, Tesla was in a unique position to understand science through both an Eastern and Western model. Like all great scientists, Tesla looked deeply into the mysteries of the outer world, but he also looked deeply within himself. Like the ancient yogis, Tesla used the term Akasha to describe the etheric field that extends throughout all things. Tesla studied with Swami Vivekananda, a yogi who brought the ancient teachings of India to the West. In the Vedic teachings, Akasha is space itself, the space that the other elements fill, which exists simultaneously with vibration. The two are inseparable. Akasha is yin to prana's yang. ¶¶ A modern concept that can help us to conceptualize Akasha, or the primary substance, is the idea of fractals. It wasn't until the 1980s that advances in computers allowed us to actually visualize and reproduce mathematically the patterns in nature. The term fractal was coined in 1980 by mathematician Benoit Mandelbrot, who studied certain simple mathematical equations that, when they are repeated, produce an unending array of changing mathematical or geometrical forms within a limited framework. They are limited, but at the same time, infinite. A fractal is a rough geometric shape that can be split into parts, each of which is at least approximately a reduced size copy of the whole pattern, a property called self-similarity. Mandelbrot's fractals have been called the thumbprint of God. You are seeing artwork generated by nature itself. If you turn the Mandelbrot figure a certain way, it looks sort of like a Hindu deity or Buddha. This figure is being termed the Buddha Bro figure. If you look at some forms of ancient art and architecture, you will see that humans have long associated beauty and the sacred with fractal patterns. Infinitely complex, yet every part contains the seed to recreate the whole. Fractals have changed mathematicians' views of the universe and how it operates. With each new level of magnification, there are differences from the original. Constant change and transformation occurs as we traverse from one level of fractal detail to another. This transformation is the cosmic spiral, the embedded intelligence of the matrix of time-space. Fractals are inherently chaotic, full of noise and order. When our minds recognize or define a pattern, we focus on it, as if it is a thing. We try to find the patterns we see as beautiful. But in order to hold the pattern in our minds, we must push away the rest of the fractal. To comprehend a fractal with the senses is to limit its movement. All energy in the universe is neutral, timeless, dimensionless. Our own creativity and capacity for pattern recognition is the link between the microcosm and macrocosm, the timeless world of waves, and the solid world of things. Observation is an act of creation through limitations inherent in thinking. We are creating the illusion of solidity, of things by labeling, by naming. The philosopher Kierkegaard said, "If you name me, you negate me." By giving me a name, a label, you negate all of the other things I could possibly be. You lock the particle into being a thing by pinning it down, naming it. But at the same time, you are creating it, defining it to exist. Creativity is our highest nature. With the creation of things comes time, which is what creates the illusion of solidity. Einstein was the first scientist to realize that what we think of as empty space is not nothing. It has properties. And intrinsic to the nature of space is nearly unfathomable amounts of energy. The renowned physicist Richard Feynman once said, "There is enough energy in a single cubic meter of space to boil all the oceans in the world." Advanced meditators know that in the stillness lies the greatest power. The Buddha had yet another term for the primary substance, what he termed kalapas, which are like tiny particles or wavelets that are arising and passing away trillions of times per second. Reality is, in this sense, like a series of frames in a holographic film camera, moving quickly so as to create the illusion of continuity. When consciousness becomes perfectly still, the illusion is understood, because it is consciousness itself that drives the illusion. Traditions of the East, it has been understood for thousands of years that all is vibration. Nada Brahma, the universe is sound. The word nada means sound or vibration, and Brahma is the name for God. Brahma simultaneously is the universe and is the creator. The artist and the art are inseparable. In the Upanishads, one of the oldest human records from ancient India, it is said, Brahma the creator, sitting on a lotus, opens his eyes, and a world comes into being. Brahma closes his eyes, and a world goes out of being. Ancient mystics, yogis, and seers have maintained that there is a field at the root level of consciousness, the Akashic field, or the Akashic records, where all information, all experience, past, present, and future, exists now and always. It is this field or matrix from which all things arise, from subatomic particles to galaxies, stars, planets, and all life. You never see anything in its totality, because it is made up of layer upon layer of vibration, and it is constantly changing, exchanging information with Akasha. A tree is drinking in the sun, the air, the rain, the earth. A world of energy moves in and out of this thing we call a tree. When the thinking mind is still, then you see reality as it is, all aspects together. The tree and the sky and the earth, the rain and the stars are not separate. Life and death, self and other, are not separate. Just as the mountain and the valley are inseparable. In the Native American and other indigenous traditions, it is said that everything has spirit, which is simply another way of saying everything is connected to the one vibratory source. There is one consciousness, one field, one force that moves through all. This field is not happening around you. It is happening through you and happening as you. You are the you in universe. You are the eyes through which creation sees itself. When you wake from a dream, you realize that everything in the dream was you. You were creating it. So-called real life is no different. Everyone, everything is you. The one consciousness looking out of every eye. Under every rock. Within every particle. International researchers at CERN, the European Laboratory for Particle Physics, are searching for this field that extends throughout all things. But instead of looking within, they look to the outer physical world. Researchers at the CERN Laboratory in Geneva, Switzerland, announced that they had found the Higgs boson, or the God particle. The Higgs boson experiments prove scientifically that an invisible energy field fills the vacuum of space. CERN's Large Hadron Collider consists of a ring 17 miles in circumference, in which two beams of particles race in opposite directions, converging and smashing together at nearly the speed of light. Scientists observe what comes out of the violent collisions. The standard model cannot account for how particles get their mass. Everything appears to be made of vibration, but there is no thing being vibrated. It is as if there has been an invisible dancer, a shadow, dancing hidden in the ballet of the universe. All the other dancers have always danced around this hidden dancer. We have observed the choreography of the dance, but until now we could not see that dancer. The so-called God particle, the properties to the base material of universe, the heart of all matter which would account for the unexplained mass and energy that drives the universe's expansion. But far from explaining the nature of the universe, the discovery of the Higgs boson simply presents an even greater mystery, revealing a universe that is more mysterious than we ever imagined. Science is approaching the threshold between consciousness and matter. The eye with which we look at the primordial field and the eye with which the field looks at us are one and the same. The German writer and luminary Wolfgang von Goethe said, "The wave is the primordial phenomenon which gave rise to the world." Cymatics is the study of visible sound. The word cymatics comes from the Greek root cyma, which means wave or vibration. One of the first Western scientists to seriously study wave phenomena was Ernst Chladni, a German musician and physicist who lived in the 18th century. Chladni discovered that when he spread sand on metal plates and then vibrated the plates with a violin bow, the sand arranged itself into patterns. Different geometrical forms appeared depending on the vibration produced. Chladni recorded an entire catalog of these shapes, and they are referred to as Chladni figures. Many of these patterns can be found throughout the natural world, such as the markings of the tortoise, or the spot patterns of a leopard. ¶¶ Studying Chladni patterns or cymatic patterns is one secret way in which high-end guitar, violin, and other instrument makers determine the sound qualities of the instruments they make. Hans Jenny expanded on Chladni's work in the 1960s. Using various fluids and electronic amplification to generate sound frequencies and coined the term cymatics. If you run simple sine waves through a dish of water, you can see patterns in the water. Depending on the frequency of the wave, different ripple patterns will appear. The higher the frequency, the more complex the pattern. These forms are repeatable, not random. The more you observe, the more you start to see how vibration arranges matter into complex forms from simple repeating waves. This water vibration has a pattern similar to a sunflower. Simply by changing the sound frequency, we get a different pattern. Water is a very mysterious substance. It is highly impressionable. That is, it can receive and hold on to vibration. Because of its high resonance capacity and sensitivity, and an inner readiness to resonate, the water responds instantaneously to all types of sonic waves. Vibrating water and earth make up the majority of mass in plants and animals. It is easy to observe how simple vibrations in water can create recognizable natural patterns. But as we add solids and increase the amplitude, things get even more interesting. Adding cornstarch to water, we get more complex phenomena. Perhaps the principles of life itself can be observed as vibrations move the cornstarch blob into what appears to be a moving organism. The animating principle of the universe is described in every major religion using words that reflect the understanding of that time in history. In the language of the Incas, the largest empire in pre-Columbian America, the word for human body is Alpacamasca, which means literally animated earth. In Kabbalah, or Jewish mysticism, they talk about the divine name of God, the name that cannot be spoken. It cannot be spoken because it is a vibration that is everywhere. It is all words, all matter. Everything is the secret word. The tetrahedron is the simplest shape that can exist in three dimensions. Something must have at least four points to have physical reality. The triangle structure is nature's only self-stabilizing pattern. In the Old Testament, the word tetragrammaton was often used to represent a certain manifestation of God. It was used when talking about the Word of God, or the special name of God, Logos or Primordial Word. The ancient civilizations knew that at the root structure of the universe was the tetrahedral shape. Out of this shape, nature exhibits a fundamental drive toward equilibrium, Shiva, while it also has a fundamental drive towards change, Shakti. In the Bible, the Gospel of John usually reads, "In the beginning was the Word," but in the original text, The term used was logos. The Greek philosopher Heraclitus, who lived around 500 years before Christ, referred to the logos as something fundamentally unknowable, the origin of all repetition, pattern, and form. The Stoic philosophers who followed the teachings of Heraclitus identified the term with the divine animating principle pervading the universe. In Sufism, the Logos is everywhere and in all things. It is that out of which the unmanifest becomes manifest. In the Hindu tradition, Shiva Nataraja literally means Lord of the Dance. The whole cosmos dances to Shiva's drum. All is imbued or ensouled with the pulsation. Only as long as Shiva is dancing can the world continue to evolve and change. Otherwise, it collapses back into nothingness. While Shiva is representative of our witnessing consciousness, Shakti is the substance or stuff of the world. While Shiva lies in meditation, Shakti tries to move him, to bring him into the dance. Like yin and yang, the dancer and the dance exist as one. Logos also means unconcealed truth. He who knows the Logos knows the truth. Many layers of concealment exist in the human world, as Akasha has been swirled into complex structures, concealing the source from itself. Like a divine game of hide and seek, we have been hiding for thousands of years, eventually forgetting about the game completely. We somehow forgot that there was anything to find. In Buddhism, one is taught to directly perceive the Logos, the field of change, or impermanence within oneself through meditation. When you observe your inner world, you observe subtler and subtler sensations and energies as the mind becomes more concentrated and focused. Through the direct realization of anicca, or impermanence at the root level of sensation, one becomes free of attachment to transient external forms. Once we realize there is one vibratory field that is the common root of all religions, how can we say, my religion, or this is my primordial own, my quantum field? The true crisis in our world is not social, political, or economic. Our crisis is a crisis of consciousness, an inability to directly experience our true nature. An inability to recognize this nature in everyone and in all things. In the Buddhist tradition, the Bodhisattva is a person with an awakened Buddha nature. A Bodhisattva vows to help to awaken every being in the universe, realizing that there is only one consciousness. To awaken one's true self, one must awaken all beings. There are innumerable sentient beings in the universe. I vow to help them all to awaken. My imperfections are inexhaustible. I vow to overcome them all. The Dharma is unknowable. I vow to know it. The way of awakening is unattainable. I vow to attain it.
Om Mitakuryasa. I think we needed that, everybody. There's more where this came from. Let's do this every week for a while here. Oh, wonderful, wonderful. Thank you, Rama. Okay, are you going to rearrange the board there? Oh, boy. That is the transformation that it's until I reach enlightenment, I take refuge in all the Buddhas and in the Dharma and the Sangha by the merit of accomplishing the six perfections, love, truth, peace, freedom, justice, and beauty. May I achieve enlightenment for the benefit of all sentient beings. That is the work. That is the new Sarah Law. That is the one. We are so all one. Think very quickly now. Things are changing. That's quite an amazing piece. That piece is a Jamie Dimon piece. Okay, I'm going to read something our dear sister Mary Margaret sent to us. It's called Dragonfly Portal. The Hathors, it's from yesterday through the 21st, a 7-day period. And it's transformation, breaking of illusions. I just want to say there's a beautiful movie with Kevin Costner and it's called Dragonfly. And for the sake of our posterity, that story is beautiful. Haven't seen that movie. You can probably pull it up on your computer. You can watch it on YouTube. Just put in Dragonfly by Kevin Costner. I never quite heard of the Dragonfly portal having to do with the Hathors. The Hathors are cow people, everybody. So the way of the path that India talks about the sacred cow, I guess, and the way of the dragonfly. I was a water sprite. I had wings, too, and only a water sprite, a dragonfly, is a partner. Yes, indeed. Okay, here we go. In Lemuria, we were talking about that. I was talking about there. Okay. As the clock on the calendar of the human understanding of time comes to a full circle of light and love, as the clock strikes the hour of the hours, and the eternal blessings and blossoming of the energies therein unleash, all on your planet shall begin to feel the upliftment, the tremendous change within the psyche of our being. For the portal of joy and rebirth, change and transformation, a portal of the dragonfly has opened its beautiful self up to humanity to assist you in opening the gateway of your psyche and breaking through the illusions, the restraints, the constraints, reaching the eternal truth of the Creator and our Creator selves. for we are one. And so, for the next 7 of our earthly days, well, it started yesterday, now this is the countdown here, 6, tomorrow's 5, of our earthly days, the portal shall continue to be in effect, during which time many of us who are dwelling on earth shall have the opportunity to complete the cleansing and take flight into another state of being, flight into another realm of the etheric proportions, uplifting our consciousness and creating the heaven that we all desire to see manifest on earth, shall first be recognized within the psyche of our being. And so, dearly beloved children of light, we, the Hathors of the new world, the Hathors of the olden day, the Hathors of the light, the Hathors of love, of the heavens, and here today to encourage us to utilize the time now in the utmost possible advantageous position for humanity. Know that throughout the duration of this window of opportunity, our light bodies shall expand trifold. Our energy fields shall buzz with renewed lightness of being. And the magnificent wave upon wave of contentment, of bliss, of joy, of love, of tremendous potential shall rise from deep within our being and spread throughout our sphere of influence with vigor, with splendor, culminating in a fruitful abundance for all of humanity. And so, on the date of our full moon rising, and remember, 3 days before, 3 days after. And remember, everybody, put a gallon of good water out under the moonlight, and it will charge it with the Metatronic energy, which is the energy that returns the etheric blueprint of the original kind to all life, in within and without. Yeah, we're learning so much now about frequencies and numbers and water and sound and color and vibration. And so, dearly beloved children of light, the next 7 of our earthy days, the portal shall continue to be in effect, during which time many of us who are dwelling on earth shall have the opportunity to complete the cleansing and take flight. Flight into this next state of being, flight into this other realm of etheric proportion, uplifting our consciousness and creating heaven, that heaven we all desire to see manifest on earth, shall be first recognized with the psyche of our being. And so again, dear beloved children of light, we the Hathors of the new world, the Hathors of the olden days, the Hathors of the light and the love of the heavens, and here now today to encourage us to utilize the time, as we said, in the utmost possible advantageous position for all of humanity. The Hathors are mother's people, everybody. Indeed they are. Know that throughout the duration of this window of opportunity, our light bodies shall expand trifold. Our energy fields shall buzz Our energy shall buzz with renewed lightness of being. And the magnificent wave upon wave of contentment, bliss, joy, love, and tremendous potential shall arise from deep within our being and spread throughout our sphere of influence with vigor, with splendor, culminating in a fruitful abundance for all of humanity. And so, on the date of our full moon rising, Ram? Are you sure? Okay. Okay. Sorry, I figured out what that. And on the date of our full moon rising, the heavenly doors to the psyche that dwell therein shall spread open the opportunity to breathe in the new light and the new love, and shall once more be bestowed upon humanity by the heavenly abode of the source of the gods and the goddesses that we are. Understand, dearly beloveds, that we are the co-creators of our own reality, and that which we weave in our dream, that which we weave in our mind's eye, shall then be manifest and integrated into the reality that we see before us. As we awaken to such a realization, we shall take flight. Flight and lightness. And we shall see that which we have not seen prior. Each and every obstacle within our path shall suddenly turn into a beautiful experience from which we are to learn much about our own self and selves surrounding us. We are to take every opportunity to expand our consciousness in order to allow more light, more love, more joy, more abundance, more harmony, and more eternal understanding of truth to enter our being. For from the being of our own self, we shall then be able to spread forth the informational decree that we are to anchor into the Gaia and all who dwell herein. Hey, Lord Rama, you know those Sufi poems? Maybe you could find another one of those. That sounds really awesome. Maybe you could look around, you know. You might want to do that while we have a chance here. Okay, yeah. Yeah, that would be good. Yeah. Yeah. Like a really beautiful one, maybe 15 minutes or so. Okay. For from the being of our own self, we shall then be able to spread forth the informational decree that we are the author and we are to anchor into the Gaia and all who dwell therein, melting the illusions away, making the way for the eternal truth of the Creator and our own Creator selves. For we cannot reiterate this enough, that each and every single one of us is a powerful being. Indeed, it is so, and so it is. And thus, without the full and proper understanding, overstanding, and comprehension that it is so, it is not possible for us to change the world and create that which we deem to see. For we must understand, we must overstand, and fully incorporate this understanding, overstanding, that all of us are powerful, all of us are limitless, all of us beings who have come from heavens above in order to institute a new directional flow of energies, a new thinking pattern to all who dwell upon Gaia, in order to assist these beautiful souls to flourish into the new understanding, overstanding of unconditional love. in order to assist them to bring out from the veil of forgetfulness, to break out from the veil of forgetfulness, from the falsehood of history of mankind as a whole, and their own individual structural remembrance of their own beings, in order to usher in the new age of eternal Om. And so, beginning on the date of our full moon rising, we are to take the opportunities presenting themselves to us and transform ourselves into a dragonfly from within our own psyche. Spread our wings fearlessly, dearly beloveds. Take flight from within our hearts and allow our own consciousness to expand, to transform, to transmute all that stands in the way of light. We are with you. We love you. Goodbye for now. A personal note. I started searching for the spiritual meaning of the dragonfly after I received this message, and here is what I found. Dragonfly symbolism reveals how to get beyond illusion. Dragonfly totem teaches the magic of shifting vibration with the use of color and shows us the path to new worlds as she dances in and out of mystical portals. Dragonfly totem leads us through the mists of change to the land of magic, where we find our true power and we hear the wisdom of our very soul. Dragonfly spirit animal is a very powerful messenger of the delights of magic. Dragonflies are full of mysticism and powers of illusion. The spiritual meaning of the dragonfly totem symbolizes going past self-created illusion that limits growth and change. Dragonflies are the embodiment of color magic and transformation. Dragonfly totem energy reminds us of the divine message of light. As the dragonfly reflects the light and opens creative imagination to flow in our lives, dragonfly symbol appears to each and every one of us, capable of moving in all directions, speaking to us of pure potential, giving the gift of flashes of vision and inspiration for what we can create in our lives, how we can skillfully maneuver the terrain with swift precision actions and movements. This is why transformation is a common dragonfly symbolism. And you can find this little piece at spiritanimal.info/dragonfly-spirit-animal/dragonfly-spirit-animal/. The Hathors, channeled by Anna Merkaba, Distant Energy Healer, Channeler, Lightworker, a book to book a healing or a psychic session with Anna, and for more channeled messages to help on our journey to self-discovery, we can go to Sacred Ascension, Key of Life. Sacred Ascension Merkaba.wordpress.com. Yeah. Discover your true self through the vibrational messages from behind the veil. And there's no WWs, just http://. SacredAscensionMerkaba.wordpress.com. Ah, beauty is as beauty does, everybody. Okay, I'm going to take a moment to read the story of Saint Valentine of Terni and his disciples. This is an absolutely beautiful story, everybody. I never forgot this story. I actually read this story the first time in a children's book. That was just gorgeous, and it just brought the heart energy out. I will read this from what we found here on the internet. Shrine of St. Valentine at Whitefriar Street Carmelite Church in Dublin, Ireland. There's a picture there depicting this. St. Valentine's Day, also known as Valentine's Day, or the Feast of St. Valentine, is observed on February 14th each year. It is celebrated in many countries around the world, although it is not a holiday in most of them. St. Valentine's Day began as a liturgical celebration of one or more early Christian saints named Valentinus. Several martyrdom stories were invented for the various Valentines that belonged to February 14th and added to later martyrology. Oh my goodness, it's interesting. A popular hagiographical account of St. Valentine of Rome states that he was imprisoned for performing weddings for soldiers who were forbidden to marry and for ministering to Christians who were persecuted under the Roman Empire. According to legend, during his imprisonment, he healed the daughter of his jailer, Asterius. An embellishment to this story states that before his execution, he wrote her a letter signed "Your Valentine" as a farewell. Today, St. Valentine's Day is an official feast day in the Anglican Communion, as well as in the Lutheran Church. The Eastern Orthodox Church also celebrates St. Valentine's Day, albeit on July 6th and July 30th, the former date in honor of the Roman Presbyter, St. Valentine, and the latter date in honor of the Hieromartyr Valentine, the Bishop of Interama, modern Terni, T-E-R-N-I. In Brazil, the Dia de São Valentim is recognized on June 12th. The day was first associated with romantic love. In the circle of Geoffrey Chaucer, in the High Middle Ages, as the tradition of courtly love flourished, in 18th century England, it evolved into an occasion in which lovers expressed their love for each other by presenting flowers, offering confectionery, and sending greeting cards known as Valentines. Valentine's Day symbols that are used today include the heart-shaped outline doves and the figure of the winged Cupid. Since the 19th century, handwritten Valentines have given way to mass-produced greeting cards. Historical facts. Saint Valentine, baptizing Saint Lucilia, Jacopo Bassano, numerous early Christian martyrs were named Valentine. The Valentines honored on February 14th are Valentine of Rome, Valentinus Romae, and Valentine of Terni, Valentinus Interamensis Romae. Valentine of Rome was a priest in Rome who was martyred about A.D. 496 and was buried on the Via Flaminia. The relics of St. Valentine were kept in the church and catacombs of St. Valentino in Rome, which, quote, remained an important pilgrim. And throughout the Middle Ages, until the relics of St. Valentine were transferred to the Church of Santa Prasede during the pontificate of Nicholas IV. The flower-crowned skull of St. Valentine is exhibited in the Basilica of Santa Maria in Comedin, Rome. Other relics are found at Whitefriars Street Carmelite Church in Dublin, Ireland. Valentine of Terni became Bishop of Interamna, modern Terni, about A.D. 197, and is said to have been martyred during the persecution under Emperor Aurelian. He is also buried on the Via Flaminia, yet in a different location than Valentine of Rome. His relics are at the Basilica of St. Valentine in Terni, Basilica di San Valentino. Jack O'Rourke states that abstracts of the acts of the two saints were in nearly every church and monastery in Europe. The Catholic Encyclopedia also speaks of a third saint named Valentine, was mentioned in early martyrologies under the date of February 14th. He was martyred in Africa, with a number of companions, yet nothing more is known about him. St. Valentine's head was preserved in the Abbey of New Minster, Winchester, and venerated. My goodness. February 14th is celebrated as St. Valentine's Day in various Christian denominations. It has, for example, the rank of commemoration in the calendar of saints in the Anglican Communion. In addition, the feast day of St. Valentine is also given in the calendar of saints in the Lutheran Church. However, in 1969, revision of the Roman Catholic calendar of saints, the feast day of St. Valentine on February 14th was removed from the general Roman calendar and relegated to particular local or even national calendars for the following reason. Quote, though the memorial of St. Valentine is ancient, it is left to particular calendars since apart from his name, nothing is known of St. Valentine and that except that he was buried in the Via Flaminia on February 14th. The feast day is celebrated in Balsan, Malta, where relics of the saint are claimed to be found, and also through the world by traditionalist Catholics who follow the older pre-Second Vatican Council calendar. In the Eastern Orthodox Church, St. Valentine's Day is celebrated July 6th, in which St. Valentine, the Roman Presbyter, is honored. Furthermore, the Eastern Orthodox Church observes the feast of Hierom Martyr Valentine, Bishop of Interamna. July 30th. In the Dictionary of Christianity by J.C. Cooper, he writes that St. Valentine was a priest of Rome who was imprisoned. Okay, we're just repeating. Let's see. Contemporary records of St. Valentine were most probably destroyed during this Diocletian persecution in the early 4th century. In the 5th or 6th century, a work called Passio Marii et Marseille published a story of martyrdom of St. Valentine of Rome, perhaps by borrowing tortures that happened to other saints, as was usual in the literature. Okay, I'm not going to read more. I'm just going to say that I really like the story that was in the child's book because they spoke of him like he was like another Saint Francis. And he healed with herbs and plants. And the people from the whole village would come to him. And I am sure he was considered a heretic for those reasons, too. They also say here that St. Valentine wore a purple amethyst ring, customarily worn on the hands of Christian bishops, with the image of Cupid engraved on it, a recognizable symbol associated with love that was legal under the Roman Empire. Roman soldiers would recognize the ring and ask him to perform marriage for them. Probably because of the association with St. Valentine, amethyst has become the birthstone of February. Oh! And it's thought to attract love. Yes, unconditional love, everybody. Divine grace as well. Another establishment is that St. Valentine would have performed clandestine Christian weddings for soldiers who were forbidden to marry. The Roman Emperor Claudius II supposedly forbade this for his soldiers, and forbade this in order to grow his army, believing that married men did not make for good soldiers. However, this supposed marriage ban was never issued, and in fact, Claudius II told his soldiers to take two or three women for themselves after his victory over the Goths. Oh, brother, one into the other. According to legend, in order to remind these men of their vows and God's love, St. Valentine is said to have cut hearts from parchment, giving them to these soldiers and persecuted Christians. I'm just going to say they don't mention it anywhere at all that he was an herbalist and a healer with plants. And the energy of his very being was very enigmatic. Yeah. And that the father of this, in the book, it was a young boy, and they're saying it was a young girl here, but the father was a centurion, and when he had healed the boy, and then the soldiers came and arrested him, and this man was just heartbroken, and he was ordered to guard the prison cell where he was living, you know, awaiting his execution. Yet Saint Valentine just really comforted him and said, told him all the things to do to maintain the health, and he even taught him as long as he could how to use herbs so that he could continue the work that he was doing. And he taught him many things from prison, and this man stopped being a centurion as soon as possible, and he spent time helping to heal the sick and continue the work. That was a beautiful way to speak to this story. So, okay. That's good. There's many, many, many long more pages here, but I'll read this one piece. This is another piece. It's called witchology.com. W-I-T-C-H-O-L-O-G-Y.com. /contents/valentines_static.p=hharryp=paul. Saint Valentine's Day or Ancient Pagan Sex Rite. Pagan origins of a popular Christian festival. As an estimated 1 billion cards are exchanged, the Saint Valentine's Day spare a thought for the ancient pagan custom that the Catholic Church has tried to hide from you. For Saint Valentine's Day is the eve of Lupercalia, the pagan Roman festival of fertility. Love is a lottery. In fact, the 14th of February was the date specially set aside for love, lotteries in pagan Rome, a holiday devoted to Juno, queen of the gods, and patroness of marriage. And 14th was also the day on which young girls' names were written on slips of paper and thrown into jars to be picked out by the boys. Chooser and chosen would be then partnered for the duration of Lupercalia festival. Such arbitrary pairings often resulted in lasting relationships. The Catholic Church later substituted the names of dead saints in place of those of flesh and blood girls to subvert the lusty pagan practice. The Lupercalia proper began on the 15th of February with animal sacrifice and ritual flagellation. Oh my Lord. Here we go with the Opus Dei ideas. After slaughtering a goat and dog, in the sacred grotto of the she-wolf who suckled the legendary founders of Rome, the young men would run through the streets, whipping women and crops with the flayed hide of the goat to promote fertility. Archaeological evidence suggests that the Lupercalia, far from being restricted to Rome, was practiced in many other cities in Italy and Gaul. Dating from remotest antiquity, the Lupercalia was celebrated until as late as the reign of Anastasius I in 491 to 518 CE. It was toward the end of the 5th century in 498 CE that Pope Gelasius decided to dedicate the Eve of Lupercalia to the long-dead priest. The lottery system was banned as being unchristian, and the Pope did his best to make people forget about other unchristian ideas such as fertility. Mating season. However, the pagan principles of the people proved irrepressible. Memories of the Roman Lupercalia combined with folklore beliefs in Britain and France that the 14th of February marked the beginning of the mating season amongst birds to ensue that this day would persist in the popular imagination as a day of love. The oldest extant Valentine message is a poem written by Charles, Duke of Orleans, in 1415 to his wife. He had good reason to write. He was imprisoned in the Tower of London after being captured at the Battle of Agincourt. It proved a popular idea, and some years later it is believed that Henry V hired John Lydgate to compose a Valentine missive to Catherine of Valois. Despite such earlier precedents, St. Valentine's Day did not become a widely celebrated event in Britain until the 17th century. Printed cards did not appear until the late 18th century. However, it was not until the 1840s that Esther A. Howland, H-O-W-L-A-N-D, entered the history books as the first person to sell the first mass-produced Valentine cards in the United States. The magic of love, or love magic. Yet why send a card, and why make it anonymous? Either we believe one of the Christian legends and accept that we all celebrate the giving of love token of 3rd century priest by sending a replica, or look deeper into the significances of being giving and anonymous and anonymity. The act of giving stripped of a moral sentiment is usually one of status modification. For example, how many times do you hear people boasting of how they give to charity? However, in this instance, the giver's identity is carefully concealed. The card itself acts simply as the vehicle of the giver's desire. The message that accompanies such cards is most often in the imperative, be my Valentine, be my love, and so on. The structure of this exchange is remarkably similar to many magical formula. Okay, it's getting kind of late, and I'm getting kind of droopy here. Let me see. It's not too much longer. Okay. Christians against the fun. Even the Christians originally responsible for foisting St. Valentine on this festival are reassessing their position. BibleStudy.org, amongst many others, has come clean and admitted that Valentine's Day has nothing to do with a long dead saint and everything to do with our pagan heritage. Of course, they were horrified and immediately wanted to ban it. It is about time we examine these customs of the pagans, now falsely labeled Christian. It is indeed time we quit this Roman and Babylonian foolishness, this idolatry, and get back to the faith of the Christ delivered once for all time. That's something somebody's just putting in there. Let us stop teaching our children. I'm not going to read anymore. This is somebody's little podium here. Try not to forget that we are engaging in a millennia of old fertility rites. What is more, dabbling in a little magic. Further topics on Lupercalia. Okay. So Lord Rama. Ram, can you come down here and assist me so I can put the Mr. Magic Kaiser on here? It is so time. I am very happy for that. But now come hither, please. Let's get this on the road here. Okay, everybody. Max Kaiser it is.
Got to scoot.
Welcome. Welcome to the Kaiser Report. I'm Max Kaiser. You know, when Fukushima first began melting down, TEPCO threw sawdust and diapers into the disaster hole. Amazingly, it didn't work. In America, when the Deepwater Horizon oil platform exploded, BP tried plugging that disaster hole with golf balls and rubber scrap. Alas, that also didn't work. Now in the UK, welly-wearing David Cameron is out in the drowning Tory heartland throwing sandbags, soldiers, and cash impotently into the floodwaters. But, Dave, all the snooker balls in Sheffield cannot stop the rising tide that is sinking all boats into your black hole of debt economy. Because it's the triple crunch of environment, energy, and economy. And no junk shop can save us now. Not even a 147 will save us. Dave, we've been snookered. Stacy.
Yes, Max. It's a triple crunch of environment, energy, and economy, and all the buffoons are throwing everything into the risk that we see around us. The first headline, Max, is golf balls fall short coping with 21st century disasters. Chucking diapers and golf balls at multi-billion dollar calamities show methods to deal with failure are primitive at best, even as the global hunt for energy enters new frontiers of risk. Disasters beyond the coping abilities of a single company or even a country have prompted suggestions that a global body with military-scale technical resources is needed. Now, that's Bloomberg News, and they're talking in particular about energy, whether it's TEPCO or the Deepwater Horizon disaster. But, you know, look at this disaster heading our way here to the UK.
Yeah.
How many snooker balls, Max?
Snooker balls? No, do you think snooker balls could fill this disaster?
Well, it's the equivalent, you know, in Japan, they have many diapers, the adult-sized diapers that they threw into TEPCO. In the south of the United States, they have lots of golf courses down there, so they threw golf balls.
Here in the UK, snooker balls. How many snooker balls would it take to stop this disastrous hole from wiping out Britain? Let's ask Ronnie O'Sullivan.
He's the master.
Ronnie O'Sullivan, the current and five-time snooker champion, who's right here in the studio. Ronnie, welcome to the Kaiser Report.
How you doing, Max? How you doing, you all right?
All right. I saw you at the Masters. Another brilliant performance, by the way. Thank you very much. But today we're talking about disasters and snooker balls. So you're the five-time current world champion. Approximately how many snooker balls do you think would it take? Show Ronnie the photo here.
To stop this storm.
Oh, is that a storm?
Yeah.
Wow. Lots of snooker balls.
A lot.
Yeah.
Yeah, millions, billions. Billions of
billion snooker balls.
Billions.
I don't think we have enough. But that actually could save the economy if we had to manufacture a bunch of snooker balls.
Yeah, exactly. They have to manufacture a billion snooker balls, and it would stimulate the economy here in the UK, because I believe snooker balls are manufactured here in the UK. It's the world leading in snooker balls before China, of course, gets into the game. Well, fantastic then.
But this is the thing. Actually, the article points out that, you know, there's a rising risk as we're going further out into the deep waters of the oceans to drill for energy. We're going, there's more and more risk in the financial system. So just like throwing diapers and sawdust at these big environment, you know, the energy catastrophes, we're throwing all sorts of cash at financial disasters because we don't know what to do otherwise.
Well, this is the tragedy of it all, isn't it? Because for example, I don't know if you're going to get into this or not, but Cameron is saying there's unlimited money to throw at this disaster.
That is our first headline.
Yeah.
And, you know, I also wanted to point out just below the environmental disaster at the top of the page is the economic disaster at the bottom of the page, where Mark Carney is saying that the interest rates are on hold at near 0% because the recovery is unsustainable. But let's talk about what, despite this, this fragile recovery in the UK economy. Here we have David Cameron saying, UK floods, David Cameron pledges unlimited public funds. Prime Minister seeks to assert his authority over natural disaster with promise of wider army role and more money. A resolute David Cameron vowed to marshal the forces of the state to tackle the flooding crisis, pledging a wider role for the army and unlimited public funds to protect families.
Right, this is cognitive dissonance because this disaster here on the climate side, the flooding, is a direct result of totally ignoring the realities of man-made global chaos. So they totally ignore this for years, And now suddenly it's caught up to them. The economy is crashing because of interest rates being forced lower, which is keeping these zombie banks alive. And they're cannibalizing and parasitizing the UK economy. So this is cognitive dissonance all merging into one Armageddon cacophonous nightmare of too much liquidity in flooding, too much liquidity in quantitative easing. Mm. Everyone's drowning to death. They're drowning in debt. They're drowning in Cornwall. They're drowning. Everyone's drowning because of these freaking David Cameron's got his head up his schmink thing. Why can't he learn a decent craft like snooker? At least people who play snooker are doing something useful for the economy. Not freaking David Cameron, who's out there posing in the House of Commons. He's a financial illiterate.
You bring up a good point, is that it was bringing forward all the future consumption via the economy, via the monetary system and 0% interest rates. So because of that, we've already spent many decades into the future, which means we're heading out far out into the oceans to find oil, despite the fact that our technology not being decades into the future. So we have primitive technology relative to the risk we're taking on.
Yeah, well, not to mention the fact that this whole story in the last couple of years of austerity is a hoax. It's a joke. What austerity? Suddenly there's all this magical money to bail out Tories in Cornwall? What about the magical money to bail out the people in the bedroom tax scandal? Magical money to bail out people who are being cut off the NHS? Where is this magical money coming out of Dave Cameron's Schmink Schmink? What's that all about? Why doesn't it help people that are not his direct supporters? When he's criticized as being a prime minister only for the rich. I mean, this is a clear example of this. His rich buddies are being flooded. Oh, there's some magic money.
Exactly. And in fact, the quote about this in the article says that in words that may yet come back to haunt him, Cameron said, quote, "My message to the country today is this. Money is no object in this relief effort. Whatever money is needed for, it will be spent. We will take whatever steps are necessary." He insisted, quote, "We are a wealthy country and we have taken good care of our public finances. And yet, we have the bedroom tax with thousands of people, many severely disabled or pensioners being thrown out into the street because apparently that's not a disaster worth a relief."
Yeah, these words are come to haunt him now. This is the ghost of Christmas present. This is a disaster in the making today. And of course, you know, Mark Carney over there at Bank of England says, you know, the economy is not recovering and we need to keep interest rates low. So there's a direct contradiction to what Cameron is saying. He's being repudiated by his own Bank of England chairman. So those two guys are not on the same page. The economy is being whacked to death because interest rates are being kept artificially low. That's the primary cause of the economic malaise. It's also the primary cause for this flooding because his malinvestments over the last 20 years have taken money out of stuff that could be useful, like preventing floods, and put it in the bank of house speculators. You see what I'm saying? It's a misallocation of money. Engineered by these banking terrorists, as clear and simple as the nose on your face as the snooker ball going into the hole, giving Ronnie O'Sullivan another world championship. The guy's on fire. He's going to the crucible. He's going to win again. You heard it here. I'm calling it. Six-time world champion. Only behind that other guy. Higgins?
There's no other guy.
Who won more? Higgins?
Nobody.
Who won?
Stephen Hendry.
Stephen Hendry?
Seven.
Well, what's the fastest he's ever done 147?
About 7-8 minutes, maybe.
Well, was he on, was he smoking dope or something? I mean, that's like a grandma could do in 7 minutes. Well, you did yours in what, 520. 520 minutes. 140, 7 points in 500, 5 minutes and 20 seconds. It's like bam, 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 bam. I even freaking Einstein could do that.
So, Max.
Yeah.
We were talking about the triple crunch, and we were talking about over in not just Cornwall, Somerset, and places like this where you're seeing people made homeless because their homes are flooded, about 6,000 of them. And then you talked about housing speculation. Now, that catastrophe of liquidity of money is also making people homeless but distressed. Tweet from the Telegraph reads, "If salaries had risen as fast as house prices, an average couple would earn £44,000 more a year."
Right. The house is making more money for them than their job. Okay. That's ludicrous because it means that the house prices are trading at 5, 6, 7 times multiple of income. That's completely unsustainable. It's only being kept artificially aloft through this manipulation of interest rates, which comes, you know, what's happening in Canada right now? Before we came on, I looked at the press coming out of Canada. That housing bubble that Mark Carney inflated during his stay at Bank of Canada governor is now bursting. And those people are going into a massive flood of negative equity. Okay. That's the the legacy of Mark Carney. He's a serial bubble blower. And when he blows up this economy, he'll go to some other freaking country and ruin their economy. He's a disaster.
One of the worst areas in terms of wages not keeping pace with the inflation of house prices is Hackney. Hackney wages would need to be four times higher to keep pace with house price rises just over the past 15 years. So they are earning in Hackney the equivalent of £31,304. But if they wanted to keep pace with house price inflation there, the £31,000 would need to be £131,924 per year.
Right. Again, it's cognitive dissonance because here in the UK, you had a strike from transportation workers and the rail system was shut down for a couple of days. And people are saying, oh, my God, you're victimizing us. You're penalizing us. We can't get to work. Why should we pay you anything? Well, without paying anybody anything, you're not going to have the income to support this housing bubble. The only way you can support the housing bubble is by quantitative easing, free money printing out of the Bank of England, which has an end date. It blows up like every single Ponzi scheme in history. This one will similarly blow up. And then you'll be begging your neighbor who's working down at the subway stop for a nickel to buy a cup of coffee because you're guggling. I'm an idiot. Don't you understand? There's a connection. Economics is about connections.
Well, in fact, so they need to earn £131,000 there. Forget all of the central London where you're going to need to earn £290,000 or more just to keep pace with inflation. But as you see, David Cameron, in order to stop this storm coming in, there's three more coming. If you look on the front page of the Daily Mail today, there's three storms out into the Atlantic heading this way. And in order to stop that, he's saying he's going to give, no matter how much money needs to be printed, he's going to throw it at this storm, which of course is going to drive up house prices in Hackney, which means by the end of this year, end of 2014, those people will need to earn £250,000 instead of £131,000 to afford their property.
So he's had this vision of these three storms coming into London. It's like, but there's Ronnie O'Sullivan, right? And he's in a parallel universe. And it's being ripped to shreds by cosmic forces. But he's still sinking pots. Somehow, between Ronnie O'Sullivan and the devil, it would be Ronnie O'Sullivan. He would win. It's not natural. It's not natural.
Well, we definitely...
He's an alien. He's from another universe. On that note, we have to say goodbye. Stacy, thank you.
I'm off to go find a billion sticker balls.
Hey, Ronnie, thanks so much for being on the show.
Thanks for having the show, Max. Cheers.
All right, stay tuned for the second half. A whole lot more. Welcome back to the Kaiser Report. I'm Max Kaiser. Time now to turn to Nafiz Ahmed, an author and an environment writer for the Guardian newspaper, where he tracks the geopolitics of environmental, energy, and economic crises via his Guardian-hosted blog, Earth Insight. Welcome to the Kaiser Report.
Thanks, Max.
Okay, so you write about the triple crunch of environment, energy, economic crisis. Clearly, we've got this flooding going on in the UK, so we're having you on. Talk a little bit about it.
Okay, so I mean, obviously, it's a lot of people are recognizing that the nature of the weather at the moment is a little bit unprecedented. It's not been seen for a good few decades. This intensity of kind of extreme rain and flooding and storms and things like that. Certainly, I think for the incumbent Tory party, it's come as a bit of a shock because it's you know the standard line is, you know, we don't really need to do anything urgent on climate change. Obviously, we need to do some things. And suddenly, you know, we've been hit unexpectedly by this extreme weather.
It is a shock. It's like almost people make the comparison to Katrina disaster in America, where they had this enormous breach of the levees and the floods and everything collapsed. And there's David Cameron and his wellies looking, you know, like the deer caught in the headlights. Like, where did this come from? And, you know, it's the cost of cognitive dissonance, you know, for so many decades, like climate chaos was something that everyone thought they could deal with next year and the next decade, but it's here today, right?
Absolutely. I think this is one of the things that climate scientists keep trying to say is that, yeah, we can't tell you exactly what will happen next year. We can give you the broader trends, and the broader trends are there will be more extreme weather, but we don't know how that's going to play out. What they are saying is that you know, there's going to be a greater probability of wild cards like this. So this is the kind, this is the problem. You know, there's a greater probability that you can have damaging events. I mean, one year might be fine. Another year might be really, really terrible. This is just, again, so there is certainly a bit of chance, but I think the problem is that the climate change loads the dice in favor of slightly more erratic events. And this is what we're seeing. But the repercussions are worrying, because now we've got like some 2,000 soldiers on standby around the country to kind of respond. So there is this danger that if we don't actually deal with things properly, we end up having the military to come in and deal with things and mop up. But that's not a great thing in the long term, because one, that's very costly. Two, of course, then there's going to be questions about, well, who's going to be running our civilian institutions, you know, in 10, 20 years time, if things get worse, you know, are we going to see a militarization of our society, a creeping militarization?
Which would be another trend similar to what we've seen in the U.S. But now, looking at the whole climate debate going back 20 years, 30 years, it seems like climate scientists 30 years ago, 20 years ago, 10 years ago, 5 years ago, laid out a scenario. And pretty much everything they predicted is now in your face. This is what they've been saying. So when I watch the BBC this week, at the end of their reports on this catastrophe, they'll say, almost as an addendum, oh, and some think it might have something to do with climate change, when clearly that should be the lead of the story. Climate change is here. Climate chaos is here, and it's going to be extremely costly. Why is the mainstream media here, I mean, not the Guardian, obviously, but why is like the BBC, not to pick on them, but they're the state broadcaster. Why are they pushing the propaganda that this might be an issue instead of coming out and saying this is a freaking problem?
This is an interesting question, because I mean, it's something that that's bothered me about the BBC's reporting on climate change. There's been this tendency, and it's funny you figure out that, because the BBC's actually been pretty bad on the way they handle climate change. They have to have balance, and the way they do balance is, if you have climate scientists talking about climate change, then to balance that, you have a complete non-scientist, wacko, you know, kind of theorist who maybe has an economics degree,
right,
or something,
so to make, funded
by the oil industry.
to represent the debate, they would have 99 scientists talking about the reality of climate change and one wacko. But because it's the BBC, they'll have one scientist versus one wacko. So the perception from people watching TV is that there's an equal debate, that there's somehow a debate going on here. But it's not a debate. You know, leading up to the Iraq war and all these other wars that the UK spends all this money on, the reason that they went in there, according to Tony Blair and others, is that there might be 1% chance of there being a weapon of mass destruction. So we're going to blow £1 trillion on that 1% chance that there might be, and if, of course, there wasn't. Here you've got a 98 to 99% probability. There's only a 1% chance that this climate catastrophe is not happening, and yet the response is zero. I mean, I don't mean to, you know, but talk about – I'm very frustrated by this, because I've been talking about this for years, and now that it's happening, it seems that the reality of this problem is still not getting into people's nuts.
Well, I think there's public opinion, which is obviously subject to that manipulation, the various interests that control the media discourse, and they're trying to put out whatever their view is. But I think, you know, the fundamental problem is who really has captured government policy? What are the interests that have captured government policy? And what is worrying is that it's not that David Cameron, perhaps, you know, and other people around him don't believe in climate change. I think the Tory party is extraordinary. You have the kind of counterpart in the States with the Tea Party and the Republicans. And you have elements who just deny climate change. But what's interesting is that all those deniers consistently have links to the fossil fuel industry. And whether some of them actually believe what they're saying, and I think a lot of them do, but some of them clearly maybe aren't interested in the truth and just want to make sure that they sustain the current structure of the global economy, which is heavily dependent on fossil fuels and the continued exploitation of fossil fuels.
Right. The fake denial industry, funded by the fossil fuel industry, for some reason, unlike the fake people that support GMO food, funded by GMO foods, they get called out. The people who used to support cigarette smoking, as supported by the tobacco industry, they finally get called out. But the clear connection between fossil fuels and climate change denial, for some reason, even smart folks in the U.S., like the Drudge Report, who does a lot of reporting, or the people who are tapped into the Drudge Report, my friends in Austin. But, you know, your work covers not just the environment, but the economy and really how it all works together geopolitically. And there's another big element to this that people should understand. it has to do with food. So talk about the food connection.
Well, the food crisis is we've been starting to see that with the high food prices since the 2008 banking collapse and the kind of coinciding with high oil prices. We've seen high food prices, and we've heard in the news, you know, it's affected a lot of places. It's affected things in the Arab Spring, for example. It's kind of kicked off riots. They've had food riots in Africa. And, you know, there's been this kind of perception that, okay, there's a food issue here. But again, in the mainstream debate, it's like, well, this thing might go away. Things with food production will catch up soon. It's kind of a temporary issue. But this is a result of all of the different factors coming together. You've got climate change, when we've had this bouts of extreme weather and erratic weather in all of the major food basket regions over the last few years, in Russia, in India, in the United States, grain, wheat, rice, all of our main staple food crops have faced failures, harvest failures, successively in the last few years because of these droughts and floods and all that kind of thing.
Okay, let me jump in because, you know, this goes back 100 years. It goes back to Malthus, who famously was talking about the misery of expanding populations and not being able to be fed by limited supply of food. And then every decade or so, every 50 years, every 100 years, there's a technological revolution. In the 60s, you had the Green Revolution, as it was called then, where advanced use of fertilizers and phosphates and everything that swept the globe, and the food crisis was abated. And so the critics will say, why isn't that going to happen again? There's going to be a technological solution. Monsanto, who's inventing stuff in their laboratories, why won't technology save the day again as it has in the past?
Well, I think the problem with this debate, as it's put forward in that way, is that you've got they're very abstract and theoretical, and both of those sides are wrong. You know, you've got the Malthusians who are like, it's all to do with too many people and everyone's going to die. And then you've got the kind of other extreme, which is, don't worry, technology's going to save us. It's cool. And the reality is that you can't prove either of those things. Those are just abstract and unscientific statements. What we need to do is look at what's actually happening, why it's happening, where it might go. And is there stuff we can do about it? I think the reality is that, I mean, there's been a number of peer-reviewed papers, which are quite worrying, which have been looking at crop yields over the last decade or so. And the reality is that industrial agriculture does seem to be reaching its limits in its current form. And it's because of desertification, soil erosion, climate change, and also, you know, the high food prices are being underpinned by the rising oil prices, which is to do with this other issue of energy depletion. Fossil fuels are becoming much more expensive.
Okay. Oil is becoming much more expensive. In the oceans, what percentage of the fish used for food is now depleted? Over 90%, right?
Absolutely.
90% of fish for food fish, is that what you call them? Food fish, fish for food, all the cash food fish are gone, right? So that's due to the same trends we see. In China, the pollution is so bad that the soil is now screwed for 100 years. Fukushima disaster, you know, nuclear energy catastrophe. Absolutely, so the supply of food is diminishing due to various economic and ecological disasters in hotspots. In Brazil, that just came out of the report, a huge drought. California, enormous drought. It's all being scorched. So I just want to talk about, we got about 2 minutes left. You mentioned about food prices. Now, there's two components in food prices. Because you're an economist and a geopoliticist and an environmentalist, we're going to stretch over all these different, you know, because you're a generalist, essentially, is what you are, because you have actual knowledge about how things are connected, unlike a lot of writers who are very focused on a silo, and they get kind of in these traps where they don't see the connection. So you talk about food prices. There's two components. One is on the supply of food issue. There's constraints because of climate disaster.
Yeah.
But on the other hand, there's also money printing that's going on to bail out banks. Mm. And so in this country, when a lot of the food prices and the inflation overall, which is really 9%, not the government stated 2%, it has to do with the irresponsibility of the central banks. And people love their house prices going up, even though it's a bubble.
Well, some certain people, people who own houses.
Right. To what extent is this cognitive dissonance fed by that illusion of rising house prices and the money printing that's stopping these folks from doing the right thing and protecting themselves against flooding?
Well, you know, the problem is that for the last, say, 50 years or so, this is how we've made growth happen. You know, growth. Obviously, there has been real innovations and industrial innovations and things, but all those innovations have slowed down dramatically. in terms of manufacturing. And more, the economic system is relied on this financialization and effectively creating innovative ways in which to basically create debt. And from creating more and more debt, you create your profit because people have to pay it back on interest. And this is basically how they've been creating a way of creating growth. And so, again, it's like we've just fallen back on the same thing. You know, let's just basically pump more money into the system, get inflation, asset prices going up, we'll make some money. The people who benefit from that primarily are not even actually property owners as such. I mean, your general average house owner, yeah, you know, for a while, some people will have their houses a bit more money, make some money out of that. But the people who are benefiting from this are a tiny minority of people involved in that speculative bubble who have the assets, who are basically making millions and if not billions. But you can't pay that money back because in a way, it's not really real. It's not based on reality.
It's not a productive asset.
It's not productive.
You can't grow, you know, almonds on a bubble, a housing Ponzi bubble.
Absolutely.
And so you're running out of food. And now, fees are out of time. Thanks so much for being on the Kaiser Report.
Thank you.
Okay, that's going to do it for this edition of the Kaiser Report with me, Max Kaiser, and Stacey Herbert. I'd like to thank our guest, Nafees Ahmed, author and environment writer at The Guardian. If you'd like to get in touch with us, tweet us at Kaiser Report. Until next time, bye, y'all.
A 53-year-old Ohio death row inmate named Dennis McGuire was executed in a way that had never been attempted before. See, normally inmates are put to death using a specific chemical concoction thought to be humane. Humane in the sense the prisoner is supposed to feel no pain. However, in this instance, the Ohio prison decided to experiment with a cocktail that had never been tried before. The injection comprised of the sedative midazolam, hydromorphine, a derivative of morphine. This deadly mix took 25 entire minutes to kill McGuire. And according to witnesses, he spent that time visibly struggling and gasping for air. So why are states turning to such unproven experimental methods of execution? Well, last year, European drug manufacturers announced that they would no longer be selling the U.S. pentobarbital, one of the primary ingredients in traditional capital punishment, because of ethical concerns. But that didn't stop several death penalty states here in the U.S. from moving forward with the practice. But beyond this barbaric ways this country executes death row prisoners, the very practice of capital punishment should be questioned. So here to debunk several of the most common arguments for the death penalty, I'm joined by anti-death penalty activist and host of Moment of Web Clarity series. Did I just say that?
Moment
right?
of Clarity.
Moment of Web Clarity series.
Web Clarity
Lee Camp,
series.
What's going on, man?
How you doing?
So Lee, before we get into the reasons of why people should or shouldn't support the death penalty, I want to go back to this terrible chemical stuff that I just talked about. I mean, don't you think that we should really make executing more humane? And don't you agree with that Utah legislator that said that we should just bring back firing squads?
Yeah, I think firing squads is definitely the way to go. Let's just go back to the Wild West. I mean, after all, this is like a caveman thing to do, put people to death. So why stop at the Wild West? I say just club people, right? Just take it back another step, right?
Just rocks and clubs. Okay, let's go over some of the most commonly cited defenses of capital punishment here in America.
Because you hear a lot of people say how great it is, how important it is.
Clearly there's a lot. Otherwise it wouldn't still be implemented here. I don't know about you, but I don't want my tax dollars going to keep murderers alive. Why should I pay to keep feeding murderers in prison?
Right. That's a great point, Abby. Well, first of all, it actually costs more to execute these people because of the court trials, because of the mandatory appeals. It costs a lot more to execute than it does to keep them alive. But secondly, it's just weird to be like, that person should die because it's 10 cents out of my taxes a year. Like, okay, so 10 cents for a murderer, no good. You don't want to pay that. What about 12 cents and it's a rapist? Well, what about 15 cents? It's a pedophile. You get a Tootsie Pop. Look, what kind of bargaining and dealing is this because of your 12 cents out of your tax dollars? It's insanity.
It is. But you cannot deny. You can't. I mean, okay, you can argue about the money, whatever. We can argue about our pocketbooks all day. But Lee, you cannot deny that killing people sends a real clear message to all the would-be murderers in the country to not kill.
Exactly. It's a great deterrent. And that's absolutely true in that it's not true. Yeah. Every study that's ever been done shows
you mean, wait,
that
people are actually still killing people right
people
now?
People apparently keep killing people despite the death penalty. There's no difference in states that have the death penalty, don't have the death penalty, which makes sense because I think, not that I've experienced it, but I think when you're murdering someone, you're not thinking, well, let's see, 10 years down the road, I wonder if I'll be put to death.
Okay, Lee, even if it's more expensive to kill these people, which, you know, who knows if you're lying on that one. Even if it really isn't a deterrent.
Yeah.
Even, you know, you're saying that there's still murders happening. I haven't seen any evidence to back that up. But even if what you're saying is true, what if it were your family? What I mean, seriously, the argument. What if it were your family?
They were horribly killed. And the question is, do you mean my family killed by a murderer, or my family member was innocent on death row?
Snap.
See?
That's the
question. What if it were your family that's innocent on death row? But then we get down to the best reason, right?
Why do you imply that these people are innocent on death row?
Well, we'll get to that in a second.
Okay.
I want to cover one other reason,
that
people always give. They always say, when you get through all the steps, they always get to the last one where they go, well, it feels good. Listen, it feels right to see Jeffrey Dahmer, Unabomber, some horrible person. It feels good to see them die. Well, here's the thing. Wouldn't it feel good to see, like, the heads of Goldman Sachs in a UFC fighting match with Brock Lesnar beaten with sacks of their own money? Yeah, it'd feel pretty good. And would it feel good to see the Real Housewives of Beverly Hills have drywall shoved in their mouths and spackled shut? Yeah, it'd feel pretty good. And would it feel good to see the heads of Exxon and Chevron dropped in oil and then covered in breadcrumbs and then sent into an enclosure with exotic birds and pets? Yeah, it'd feel pretty good, right? Why don't we do those things? Because they're morally wrong. So if we find all those things morally unacceptable, why not a racist, faulty death penalty? And we haven't even gotten into the racist thing yet.
I really do want to see the heads of Goldman Sachs.
Yeah, I know.
We all.
with their own sacks of money. I know you do, Abby. But we've decided as a society
that
it's morally wrong. But I didn't get to the racist thing yet, which is they've done studies, and in equal death penalty trials, the number one determinant of whether you're executed, race of the victim. Race of the victim.
Not the race of the perpetrator. Race of the victim?
Of the victim. So apparently, you know, killing a black person, not that big a deal. But you kill a white person, you have harmed society. Okay? So you could beat Will Smith or Oprah to death with a tennis shoe, and that doesn't really matter. But if you touch a hair on Gary Busey's head, then you have really harmed us. That's
basically what it comes down to is the death penalty is completely not only immoral, but it actually has had innocent people on death row in the past. I mean, there's a couple of famous cases. Troy Davis, of course. I mean, pretty much
nine of the 11 witnesses recanted, and one of the remaining two was the main suspect or the secondary suspect. So he probably did it. So of 11 witnesses, 10 you can wipe off.
And not to mention all the people that have already been exonerated through evidence on death row, that they were already on death row and they've been exonerated.
Since 1973, 143 have been let off death row because they've been exonerated.
What does that say?
Meaning, if they had just been killed a little faster, we would have killed innocent people.
Unbelievable. Yeah. Lee Camp, we're out of time. Anti-death penalty activist, comedian. Moment of clarity. Thanks so much for coming on.
Thanks,
Abby. That's our show, you guys. I'll break this up all over again next week. Have a great weekend, guys.
Funny, but not so funny, huh, folks? Here we go into the new dispensation, and we're still figuring this one out. You know, isn't it interesting? How are we going to handle this? Very large question, huh? Are we going to make another cycle of barbarianship or what? Oh, boy. All we know is it has begun. It has indeed begun. All right, let's see here. The beginning of the end of this drama. Okay, I read a few paragraphs in this last night, but I'll repeat them again tonight just to remind you where we are. We're on chapter 29. Of When Rocks Cry Out by Horace Butler. A dream sees the Exodus. the Hebrews had taken land in South America. From there, the story of in Numbers remembers that the Hebrews went to take land from a king called Og at a city called Edrei, and a place called Bashan. I searched day and night for Edrei and Bashan. Old maps, new maps, ancient history, modern history. Rama, did you pull up what you were going to play? Huh? You got to do that. I could find nothing of Bashan or Edrei. The Bible writer said the Hebrews, quote, turned and went up by the way of Bashan. Following the description up by the way of Bashan, I looked up against the sides of the mountain on the New Orleans map where the Americans had been. Yet there was nothing that hinted of the names of Bashan or Edrei. Too far to lose the trail now. Night after night, I pushed my sight over every inch of the eastern side of the South American continent. However, I could not find where the Hebrews had gone. 3 weeks after following the Exodus to the banks of the Jabbok River, I was still camped there. Then, on a Sunday morning, I dreamed. There had been no dream that I could remember for a long time. As I woke from the dream and rose from the bed, I was trembling with chills. I could not get warm. The dream seemed to show that I was looking on the wrong side. I put on the thickest coat I had and began considering the sides that the Bible passages had moved the Hebrews to. What was it that had sides to it that the dream was referring to? My chattering teeth and trembling lips barely got the words out. I considered the Amazon River, yet that water did not fit what the dream had seemed to show to me. What did the dream? It's the Jordan. I'm looking on the wrong side of the Jordan. The biblical narrative had said people in the Exodus went up to Bashan. Through the Atlantic Ocean flowed the strong equatorial current called the Jordan, which ran down to South America. So going up to Bashan would take the people of the Exodus to where the equatorial current, the Jordan, was coming from. In the dream, I was walking toward the sunrise. To go up the Jordan toward the sunrise would take the people of the Exodus to the western coast of Africa. I pulled open the map of Western Africa, traced my finger up the equatorial current, and there they were, the biblical cities called Edrei and Bashan. Oh, brother, now we're going back over the sea again. Oh, my God. Modern maps call the two places Ebri and Grand Bassam, or Bassam, B-A-S-S-A-M. The names were printed against the shore of the country, now being called Ivory Coast. Most scholars explained that the name Ivory Coast referred to the ivory tusks of elephants. There was a much more significant meaning to that name that had nothing to do with ivory tusks. I returned to the scriptures and tested the two West African places against the biblical narrative. The Hebrews had reached West Africa. Finally, I could follow the people of the Exodus again. I began reading at a passage in Numbers. And they turned and went up by the way of Bashan. And Og, the king of Bashan, went out against them, he and all his people, to the battle of Edrei. And the Lord said unto Moses, Fear him not, for I have delivered him into thy hand, and all his people, and his land. And thou shalt do to him as thou didst unto Sihon, king of the Amorites, which dwelt at Heshbon. Quote, So they smote him, and his sons, and all his people, until there was none left him alive, and they possessed his land. Quote, And the children of Israel set forward and pitched in the plains of Moab, on this side Jordan by Jericho. And Balak, the son of Zippor, saw all that Israel had done to the Amorites. And Moab was so sore afraid of the people, S-O-R-E, afraid of the people, because they were many. And Moab was distressed because the children of Israel. And Moab said unto the elders of Midian, Now shall this company lick up all that are around about us. As the ox licketh up the grass of the field. And Balak, the son of Zippor, was king of the Moabites at that time. He sent messengers, therefore, unto Balaam, the son of Beor, to Pethor, P-E-T-H-O-R, which is by the river of the land of the children of his people, to call him, saying, Behold, there is a people come out from Egypt. Behold, they cover the face of the earth, and they abide over against me. Numbers chapter 21, verse 33. Through Num, N-U-M. Oh, through Numbers 22 to 25. Okay, 21, 33 through 22, chapter 5. The Hebrews had sent their warriors up the equatorial current and had defeated the king called Og in West Africa at Edrei and Bashan. After that victory, the Hebrew army set forward, traveling forward with the water of the equatorial current, and returned to their settlements in South America. That understanding seemed so simple and obvious that before the dream unraveled it, that biblical transatlantic passage was fenced with blinding difficulty. Eventually, I perceived the thing that had veiled the route of the Exodus where the Hebrews crossed the sea. I had noticed that biblical narratives use the phrase passed over as a body of water was crossed. And he rose up that night and took his two wives and his two women servants and his 11 sons and passed over the ford Jabbok. Genesis chapter 32 verse 22. So he fled with all that he had, and he rose up and passed over the river and set his face forward toward the Mount Gilead. Genesis chapter 31, verse 21. I am not worthy of the least of all the mercies and of all truths which thou hast shewed unto thy servant. For with my staff I passed over this Jordan, and now I am become two bands. Genesis chapter 32 verse 10. Even as the water had been split or dammed dry, the phrase passed over would still appear. And the priest that bare the ark of the covenant of the Lord stood firm on dry ground in the midst of Jordan, and all the Israelites passed over on dry ground until all the people were passed clean over Jordan. Very confusing. Oh my God. And that's in Joshua. And that is I think I'm going to leave it there, because what we have here, we've got a little bit longer thing, so we got as far as that, and let's just leave it there, and then let us pass this long stand, Lavender Road, Rainbow Feathered, Excalibur, Emerald Serpent Feathered, Excalibur, Quetzalcoatl, Talking Stick, to Lady Master Rain Bird. Oops. Oh, I thought that Rainbird was there. I heard that noise, that bleep.
Hello?
Hello?
There you are, Rainbird. Okay.
So, when the Hebrews went up from Brazil and South America and went to the Ivory Coast, if you look at a map, you see that Pangaea divide it right there. The Ivory Coast is the continuation of Brazil. And when you put the two of them together, I just find that very interesting.
Absolutely. Very interesting. Shh. Promise it about three worlds at once and nowhere at all. Okay. I mean, this is very interesting. We will have to learn the next thing the next time, because it is time for our sister Rainbird. I love you.
Oh, yeah. Okay. All right. No, thank you, Tara. Thank you, Rama. And we do appreciate these long Saturdays. And all that we cover. And, Yeah, lots of gratitude for all of our lives here at this time. It is an honor to be here and be witness and be midwives to this shift of the ages, and that reverberates throughout the universes. Very, very interesting times. I thought that it was a Chinese curse that said, may you live in interesting times. And I don't think it's a curse. I'm kind of having fun. So I hope you all are too. And with lots of gratitude for all of our lives and for all life. And for all women standing in their power at this time of shifting that rod of power from patriarchy to matriarchy, so that we can be fully in unity consciousness. Lots of gratitude for misogyny being something of the past, and lots of gratitude for joy and ecstasy and bliss in our lives. Aho Matakwi Asa, all my relations. And I pass this talking stick back to you. Rama, I know you have something beautiful to play. Thank you for all your good music.
Yes. Okay, here we go. And let's really listen carefully. This is called The City of Saba. And the poetry by Rumi is what this is about.
There is a glut of wealth in the city of Saba. Everyone has more than enough. Even the bath stokers wear gold belts. Huge grape clusters hang down on every street and brush the faces of the citizens. No one has to do anything. You can balance a basket on your head and walk through an orchard, and it will fill by itself with overripe fruit dropping into it. Stray dogs stray in lanes full of thrown out scraps with barely a notice. The lean desert wolf gets indigestion from the rich food. Everyone is satiated with all the extra, and no one wonders about the unseen world. People of Saba feel bored with just the mention of prophecy. They have no desire of any kind maybe some idle curiosity about miracles, but that's it. This over-richness is a subtle disease. Those who have it are blind to what's wrong and deaf to anyone who points it out. The city of Saba cannot be understood from within itself, but there is a cure, an individual medicine, not a social remedy. Sit quietly and listen for a voice within that will say, be more silent. As that happens, your soul starts to revive. Give up talking in your positions of power. Give up the excessive money. Turn toward teachers and prophets who don't live in Saba. They can help you grow sweet again and fragrant and wild and fresh. And thankful for any small event. The city of Saba cannot be understood from within itself, but there is a cure, an individual medicine, not a social remedy. Sit quietly and listen for a voice within that will say, be more silent. Your soul starts to revive. Give up talking in your positions of power. Give up the excessive money. Turn toward teachers and prophets who don't live in Saba. They can help you grow sweet again, and fragrant, and wild, and fresh, and thankful for any small event.
Amazing, Rama. What does that say there? FourSeasonsProductions.com. The pictures that were film that was going across was a state of
as a healthcare guide here in the state of New Mexico, we are all required to take certain training in order to become certified as a healthcare guide.
Sorry. Healthcare training, okay. Let's do the right kind, folks. I was just going to say that the film was of the State of the Union address going on, and the airplane was Air Force One, and the city of Saba was the D.C. And so it is that Be More Silent. And we'll see you in the sound of one hand clapping, everyone. And our sister lady, Master Cheryl, will be breaking the silence tomorrow evening and Monday evening. And well worth it, those higher frequencies of unity consciousness, those things are happening in those gatherings. So 213-342-3000, and the PIN code is 946-7441 pound. And take a chance. Come and be with us and share this kind of light. This could be nothing better to do right now. Remember what the astrology is saying. The I Ching is saying it. Dragonfly is here. Let's get attuned to the unity of all of nature on our beings again. So peace and love. And again, let's keep this Valentine going. It is a true time for the change of the transformative energies to be within us. From heart to heart, bid you farewell tonight and namaste and sat nam.
Sat nam ji.
Aho mitakwiyasa.